It's your third night on the couch. You getting me so far? The reason it's your third night on the couch is because you have an unresolved conflict with that special someone. You said, he said, she said. These things happen in life. People have different opinions, needs, and interests. Sometimes people just get tired and say things they don't really mean. But once they've said them, the words are out there and cannot be retracted. Is that right? Where are my amens today? All right. But the reason this is your third night on the couch is because your conflict has not yet been resolved. And the reason your conflict has not yet been resolved is because both of you are too stubborn to take the first step. She's over there feeling bad, wishing you would just make things right by apologizing and saying how very wrong you were. You're over here, you know, on the couch for the third night, feeling bad, wishing she would just make things right by apologizing and saying how wrong she was. So you stay on the couch. It's cold there on the couch in the winter. You never sleep very well there. But you, or some very, very stubborn part of you, would rather be cold, stiff-necked, and tired for three nights in a row than go make an effort to set things right. Am I right so far? All right. This is the human heart. What a wonder. The good news is that Jesus loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life. The bad news is that we have to be willing to do what Jesus says. But being willing to do what Jesus says is exactly what we have promised to do if, like Jackson today, we have chosen to be baptized and to commit ourselves to the Lordship of Jesus Christ in our lives. Every baptism is a reminder of what all baptized people have committed to. We're in the Sermon on the Mount this morning. Some of you may know that two of us in this congregation have undertaken major scholarly work on the Sermon on the Mount, which is Matthew 5 through 7, the largest single block of Jesus' teaching in the Bible. One of these two is Emeritus Pastor Peter Ray Jones. The other is little old me. My colleague Glenn Stassel and I argued in our book, Kingdom Ethics, that the basic structure of the Sermon on the Mount has been very badly misunderstood, and that this misunderstanding very much messes up how people interpret what Jesus says in this passage and really throughout the sermon. When you look closely at this passage and others in the Sermon on the Mount, you can see why people commonly make this mistake, but also why they should stop making this mistake. So take the passage for this morning. Matthew 5:21, it's projected on your screen. You have heard that it was said to those of ancient times, you shall not murder. And that's true, it was said that in the Ten Commandments. But I say to you that if you are angry with someone, you are liable to judgment. Now, generations of Christians were taught a dyadic or intensification or high ideals interpretation of this passage, which led to this teaching in many, many churches. It is just as wrong to be angry with someone as it is to kill them. Were any of you ever taught that? This was then treated as Jesus being really, really, really strict with us, and all of us being hopelessly condemned because we have to admit it, we do get angry sometimes. It also led to the idea that it is always wrong to get angry. And if you taught it was always wrong to get angry, never be angry. But is that really true? Have you ever been angry for a good cause? Like, because your rights were being violated, or because someone else's rights were being violated? Somebody was being mistreated, especially a vulnerable person. How about a child? If you got angry because, say, a child was being abused, is that sin? And didn't Jesus get angry sometimes? Like when he turned over the money changers' tables in the temple, and when he railed against the scribes and the Pharisees for locking the gates of heaven to people? This interpretation also ignores what Jesus does with the rest of the passage. What he does is to describe an escalating pattern of anger. First you feel angry, then you call a name, an insult, then you call another name, calling a person a fool in ancient Jewish culture. It was basically calling them both stupid and godless. And we all know that escalating name-calling and abuse verbally can then also lead to violence. It certainly breaks relationships. Jesus, after describing that, surprises us with this. So, when you are offering your gift at the altar and remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled. So what we were taught to think is that what Jesus teaches us to do about anger is just to strain really, really, really hard to never be angry no matter what happens to you. But what Jesus is actually teaching us to do is something very different. Can you see it? As soon as you realize that another person has a problem with you or you have a problem with them, take the first step and try to make peace with them. That's the teaching. The power of this teaching, as Jesus presents it, is heightened by the fact that Jesus places his audience in the temple in Jerusalem and further places them at the very altar of the temple, getting ready to give a sacrifice. People did not go to the temple every day. Some people went to the temple one time in their lives, if they could get there, on pilgrimage from Africa or the Middle East, you know, somewhere over like in Assyria or whatever. The temple was God's house. The altar was the holiest place in God's house. The routine understanding would have been that the holiest thing you can do is make a sacrifice at the temple. So for us, the teaching might translate something like this. If it's Easter Sunday and the preacher has never been better and is at the height of his or her proclamation of the resurrection, or the choir is kicking it. The best Easter anthem ever. People are weeping in the aisles. It's so profound. And while you're hearing this great Easter anthem, you remember that you have an unresolved conflict with your mother or your spouse or your child or a friend. Jesus is teaching, get on up and walk out of church and go and make peace. And then maybe come back and finish the service if you got it worked out. Jesus is such a radical. He doesn't appreciate the value of church the way that we do. Jesus teaches us to be peacemakers. One of the things that Christians do, that's the series right now, things Christians do is to make peace. There's many dimensions of this. One is what you might call having a peaceable character, being a person who is peaceable in your heart. Do any of you know somebody who, no matter what room they go into, they create conflict? They could be in a room by themselves and have a ferocious argument. Conflict follows them like a cloud, and it's always somebody else's fault. So it's not because of what somebody else is doing, it's because they carry it with them wherever they go. That's not who we're supposed to be. Quite the opposite. We are to be people of a peaceable character, people who are inclined to resolve conflicts and make peace, people who do not rest easy with unresolved conflict. If a relationship is broken or frozen, we are restless. We want to make peace. We're not satisfied. It ought to be the case, according to the consistent teaching of Jesus, that people ought to be able to look at us as individual Christians and at our churches and at our families and see, you know, that's a remarkably peaceable group of people. It's one of those things Christians do. So is it true? Is it true of you? Is it true of me? Is it true of us? A peaceable people. And now to the objections. Now that this is perfectly clear, I must make it much more complicated. I know that if you have listened so far, you're probably already brimming with objections. So let's just put them on the table. You're asking things like, but what about when it seems better to let sleeping dogs lie and not bring up an issue? Am I right? What about when it seems better to leave it alone even if the sleeping dogs are lying on the couch? Choir, we got some stuff to work out with the choir, it looks like. And what about when we have tried to make peace and the person says, go away? And what about when confrontation seems to be needed, not peacemaking? And what about those situations that go beyond our personal relationships, like in government or with law or in business or in international relations? Is Jesus giving us anything relevant to those arenas? And you may be thinking, perhaps this is the Martin Luther King weekend. What would Martin Luther King think about this teaching? Our second text this morning may help. It's from the Old Testament prophet Zechariah. These are the things that you shall do. Speak the truth to one another. Render in your gates judgments that are true and make for peace. Do not devise evil in your hearts against one another. Love no false oath. For all these are things that I hate, says the Lord. This is a prophet speaking to Israel collectively. In other words, this is social ethics, not just personal ethics. One clue is in the reference to the city gates. This is where people gathered in Israel to conduct business and do what amounted to government. If you had a neighbor who was stealing your sheep, you went to the city gate, to the elders there, and said, I've got a problem with my neighbor. Can we talk it out? And the idea was that is where justice should be done, where issues should be resolved so that you could keep the peace and live in community and harmony. So it says to those at the city gate, Zechariah says, render judgments that are true and that make for peace. Get it right. Do justice. If somebody's stealing sheep, get that redressed. Get it resolved. Peace is not that you don't address it. Peace is that you get it resolved. So the social ethic, the government ethic here is the peacemaking ethic. Collectively, in each neighborhood, village, town, the people and their leaders need to do justice and make peace. They need to be people of goodwill, not evil. They need to tell the truth. They need to keep their promises. There is an intricate relationship between truth, justice, and peace. And I will illustrate with a homely little example that we'll just keep between us. I have a neighbor, lives very near me, who travels a lot. He's a single person. And his companion is a very loud, very scary German Shepherd. Now, I like little tiny dogs just like anybody else. This dog, no provision is made for this dog other than visiting food when my neighbor goes out of town, which is every couple of weeks. And the dog has a dog door so the dog can go in and out whenever he wants. Are you anticipating a problem? So, we've lived in this neighborhood for 10 years, and about once every 2 months, the dog gets a little bit agitated all night long. All night long. 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, all the way through. And I have peaceably attempted to approach my neighbor about the dog barking very loudly all night long, such that the people in 10 houses are awakened. Our houses are close to each other. And the neighbor has done nothing. I can tell you for a fact that being deprived consistently of a good night's sleep makes me angry. Would it make you angry? It makes me angry because I believe I have a basic human need for a good night of sleep if I'm going to function in the world, just like anybody else. My other neighbors feel the same way. The county recognizes this and makes provision for it by passing just laws. They're called noise and nuisance laws. You have to be quiet between 11 p.m. and 7 a.m., according to DeKalb County. My neighbor is in violation of these laws. These are good and fair laws. I strongly believe in them. And they exist to keep the peace between neighbors. Laws exist basically to coerce people to do what they should do anyway. If they won't do them anyway, then you need the law. So, one might argue that a Christian should just grin and bear it and have their night's sleep interrupted on a periodic basis all night long, just to be nice. I think that's wrong. But I did seek to make interpersonal peace and to do this, you might say, in conversation. Eventually, there was a conversation that involved an officer of the law. The point here is that sometimes there cannot be true peace between people until a problem or a grievance is addressed. Can you think about a relationship that you have where somebody says, oh, just get over it, but you can't get over it because the issue hasn't been addressed? The Christian peacemaker, as we are commanded as disciples, does seek to go and be reconciled. Jesus taught this and we obey. But Paul put an interesting little footnote in Romans 12:18 that is always very striking. Insofar as it depends upon you, live at peace with all. Isn't that interesting? Paul, I'm sure, operating from a teaching of Jesus, understood that sometimes we are perfectly prepared to live in peace with somebody else, but they are not prepared to live in peace with us. For there to be true peace between two people, the other person might have to stop doing things that harm us. Think about how many, take women as an example, have been sent back into abusive marriages and told to make peace. Because that's what you're supposed to do. We now know that that's not what you do. There can be no peace sometimes without a process involving you or others telling the other person that what they are doing is wrong and they must stop. This, by the way, was something that Martin Luther King understood. He was a serious follower of Jesus, and he took quite seriously Jesus' teachings about peacemaking. He was peaceable in his character, and he was remarkably restrained when he was being abused. But peacemaking for King did not mean accepting injustice against himself or his people. He often said that the purported peace of a racist society is not peace at all. It is the peace of domination and powerlessness. The peace, for example, of somebody who is abusing somebody else and the other person not having any power to do anything about it. Seething submission to domination is not peace. It only appears to be peace if you're not in the dominated group. So Dr. King was taking peacemaking initiatives every time he made a speech or organized a march or a boycott. By speaking the truth and challenging unjust laws and social customs, he was seeking a breakthrough toward true peace between the races. By confronting injustice, he was making peace. And so, of course, he was very often charged with disturbing the peace. Those accusations were wrong. So this is how it works, pulling back to our text. In a situation where you or I have been clearly wronged, Jesus is still calling us to try to take a step to make peace, initiate the conversation, get the ball rolling, ask for an honest dialogue. But peacemaking may not look like an apology. It may look like an urgent plea from you to a spouse or a child or a friend or a coworker to stop doing wrong things. For that person to make things right. This involves speaking the truth, seeking justice, and then agreeing to live in peace again when the issues have been resolved. But this also means that the shoe might easily be on the other foot someday. It may be somebody coming to you and saying, I have a problem with you that we need to talk about. We've got to talk through this. And if they do this thing, which takes a little bit of bravery, we have to be willing to say, oh, I didn't know, or I didn't know you had a problem with me. Can we talk about it? Let's talk it out. You listen humbly and openly. We try to find out, what have we been doing wrong that might need to be changed? We apologize. We set things right. Only if we do that, and when we do that, then we can go into the true peace of reconciliation, issue addressed and resolved, rather than what often passes for peace, sometimes in marriage too, the cold peace of a broken, frozen relationship. And isn't peacemaking like this what God did for us in Jesus Christ? While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. God came to us and took the initiative to make peace. His name is Jesus. We sinned against God, but God came to us looking to make peace with us. We had to be confronted in our sin. We had to acknowledge, as Jackson has, I am a sinner. I need Jesus. And then God says, welcome back, child. I have made provision for your reconciliation in Jesus. Ephesians 2, you who once were far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ, for he is our peace. There is no peace apart from Jesus. He is our peace. He is our peace here. He is our peace here. And he is the peace that we so desperately need in the world. Have you invited Jesus into your life? Do you enjoy peace with God? Are you taking seriously, am I taking seriously his command that we go and make peace? These are the questions that I ask you to consider as our invitation hymn is played. If you would like to ask for prayer, to join the church, to join hopefully a long line of people who are going to get baptized this year, now's the time to decide. Let us stand and sing our invitation hymn.